I had the Houston's reservation.
I thought you said you didn't have a Houston's reservation.
Rand frowned. Well, yes, sorry, I'm getting confused. I just had the idea of the Houston's reservation. But I really should have just arranged to have some lobster flown in. The cops, each of them, raised an accidental eyebrow. How very fancy. It's not that expensive to do. Anyway, we were at this rotten loggerheads, and it was one of those arguments that got bigger than it should have. I took a bite of my pancakes. I could feel the heat rushing from under my collar. We were laughing about it within the hour. Huh, was all Boney said.
And where are you on the treasure hunt? Gilpin asked.
I stood up, put down some money, ready to go. I wasn't the one who was supposed to be playing defense here. Nowhere, not right yet. It's hard to think clearly with so much going on.
Okay, Gilpin said. It's less likely the treasure hunt is an angle, now that we know she was already feeling threatened months ago. But keep me in the loop anyway, okay?
We all shuffled out into the heat. As Rand and I got into our car, Boney called out,
Hey, is Amy still a two, Nick?
I frowned at her.
A size two? She repeated.
Yes, she is, I think, I said.
Yes, she is.
Boney made a face that said, and got in her car.
What do you think that was about? Rand asked.
Those two? Who knows? We remained silent for most of the way to the hotel, Rand staring out the window at the rows of fast food restaurants blinking by, me thinking about my lies. We had to circle to find a space at the Days Inn. The payroll convention was apparently a hot ticket.
You know, it's funny how provincial I am, lifetime New Yorker, Rand said, fingers on the door handle. When Amy talked about moving back here, back along the old Mississippi River with you, I pictured green, farmland, apple trees, and those great old red barns. I have to tell you, it's really quite ugly here.
He laughed.
I can't think of a single thing of beauty in this whole town, except for my daughter.
He got out and strode quickly toward the hotel, and I didn't try to catch up. I entered the headquarters a few minutes behind him, took a seat at a secluded table toward the back of the room. I needed to complete the treasure hunt before the clues disappeared, figure out where Amy had been taking me. After a few hours' stint here, I'd deal with the third clue. In the meantime, I dialed.
Yeah?
Came an impatient voice. A baby was crying in the background. I could hear the woman blow the hair off her face.
Hi, is this Hillary Handy?
She hung up. I phoned back.
Hello? Hi there, I think we got cut off before. Would you put this number on your do not call list?
Hillary, I'm not selling anything. I'm calling about Amy Dunn, Amy Elliott. Silence. The baby squawked again, a mule that wavered dangerously between laughter and tantrum.
What about her?
I don't know if you've seen this on TV, but she's gone missing. She went missing on July 5th under potentially violent circumstances.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm Nick Dunn, her husband. I've just been calling old friends of hers.
Oh, yeah?
I wondered if you'd had any contact with her recently.
She breathed into the phone, three deep breaths. Is this because of that bullshit back in high school?
Farther in the background, a child's wheedling voice yelled out, Mom! I need you!
In a minute, Jack!
She called into the void behind her, then returned to me with a bright red voice.
Is it? Is that why you're calling me? Because that was 20 goddamn years ago. More!
I know. Look, I have to ask. I'd be an asshole not to ask.
Jesus fucking Christ, I'm a mother of 3 kids now. I haven't talked to Amy since high school. I learned my lesson. If I saw her on the street, I'd run the other way.
The baby howled.
I gotta go.
Just real quick, Hillary. She hung up, and immediately my disposable vibrated. I ignored it. I had to find a place to stow the damn thing. I could feel the presence of someone, a woman, near me. But I didn't look up, hoping she would go away.
It's not even noon, and you already look like you've had a full day. Poor baby.
Shauna Kelly. She had her hair pulled up in a high bubblegum girl ponytail. She aimed glossed lips at me in a sympathetic pout.
You ready for some of my Frito pie?
She was bearing a casserole dish, holding it just below her breasts, the saran wrap dappled with sweat. She said the words like she was the star of some 80s hair rock video. You want some of my pie? Big breakfast. Thanks, though. That's really kind of you. Instead of going away, she sat down. Under a turquoise tennis skirt, her legs were lotioned so well they reflected. She kicked me with the toe of an unblemished tree torn.
You sleeping, sweetie?
I'm holding up.
You've got to sleep, Nick. You're no good to anyone if you're exhausted.
I might leave in a little bit, see if I can grab a few hours.
I think you should. I really do.
I felt a sudden, keen gratitude to her. It was my mama's boy attitude, rising up. Dangerous. Crush it, Nick. I waited for her to go. She needed to go. People were beginning to watch us.
If you want, I can drive you home right now, she said. A nap might be just the thing for you.
She reached out to touch my knee, and I felt a burst of rage that she didn't realize she needed to go. Leave the casserole, you clingy, groupie whore, and go. Daddy's boy attitude, rising up. Just as bad. Why don't you check in with Mary Beth? I said brusquely, and pointed to my mother-in-law by the Xerox, making endless copies of Amy's photo.
Okay.
She lingered, so I began ignoring her outright.
I'll leave you to it, then. I hope you like the pie.
The dismissal had stung her. I could tell, because she made no eye contact as she left, just turned and sauntered off. I felt bad, debated apologizing, making nice. Do not go after that woman, I ordered myself.
Any news?
It was Noelle Hawthorne, entering the same space Shauna had just vacated. She was younger than Shauna, but seemed older. A plump body with dour, wide-spaced mounds for breasts. A frown on her face. Not so far.
You sure seem to be handling it all okay?
I twitched my head at her, unsure what to say.
Do you even know who I am?
She asked. Of course. You're Noelle Hawthorne.
I'm Amy's best friend here.
I had to remind the police. There were only 2 options with Noelle. She was either a lying publicity whore, She liked the cachet of being pals with a missing woman, or she was crazy. A stalker determined to befriend Amy, and when Amy shirked her...
Do you have any information about Amy, Noelle? I asked.
Of course I do, Nick. She was my best friend.
We stared each other down for a few seconds.
Are you going to share it? I asked.
The police know where to find me, if they ever get around to it.
That's super helpful, Noelle. I'll make sure they talk to you.
Her cheeks blazed red, two expressionist splatters of color. She went away. I thought the unkind thought, one of those that burbled up beyond my control. I thought, women are fucking crazy. No qualifier, not some women, not many women. Women are crazy. Once night fell fully, I drove to my dad's vacant house, Amy's clue on the seat beside me. Maybe you feel guilty for bringing me here. I must admit, it felt a bit queer. But it's not like we had the choice of many a place. We made the decision. We made this our space. Let's take our love to this little brown house. Give me some goodwill, you hot loving spouse. This one was more cryptic than the others, but I was sure I had it right. Amy was conceding Carthage, finally forgiving me for moving back here. Maybe you feel guilty for bringing me here, but we made this our space. The little brown house was my father's house, which actually was blue, but Amy was making another inside joke. I'd always liked our inside jokes the best. They made me feel more connected to Amy than any amount of confessional truth-telling or passionate lovemaking or talk till sunrising. The little brown house story was about my father, and Amy is the only person I'd ever told it to, that after the divorce, I saw him so seldom that I decided to think of him as a character in a storybook. He was not my actual father, who would have loved me and spent time with me, but a benevolent and vaguely important figure named Mr. Brown, who was very busy doing very important things for the United States, and who, very occasionally, used me as a cover to move more easily about town. Amy got tears in her eyes when I told her this, which I hadn't meant. I'd meant it as a kids are funny story. She told me she was my family now, that she loved me enough to make up for 10 crappy fathers, and that we were now the Duns, the two of us. And then she whispered in my ear, I do have an assignment you might be good for. As for bringing back the goodwill, that was another conciliation. After my father was completely lost to the Alzheimer's, we decided to sell his place, so Amy and I went through his house, putting together boxes for goodwill. Amy, of course, was a whirling dervish of doing pack, store, toss, while I sifted through my father's things glacially. For me, everything was a clue. A mug with deeper coffee stains than the others must be his favorite. Was it a gift? Who gave it to him? Or did he buy it himself? I pictured my father finding the very act of shopping emasculating. Still, an inspection of his closet revealed 5 pairs of shoes, shiny new, still in their boxes. Had he bought these himself, picturing a different, more social Bill Dunn than the one slowly unspooling alone? Did he go to Shooby Dooby, get my mother to help him? Just another in a long line of her casual kindnesses? Of course, I didn't share any of these musings with Amy, so I'm sure I came off as the gold bricker I so often am.
Here, a box.
For goodwill, she said, catching me on the floor, leaning against a wall, staring at a shoe.
You put the shoes in the box, okay?
I was embarrassed. I snarled at her. She snapped at me, and the usual.
I should add, in Amy's defense, that she'd asked me twice if I wanted to talk, if I was sure I wanted to do this. I sometimes leave out details like that. It's more convenient for me. In truth, I wanted her to read my mind so I didn't have to stoop to the womanly art of articulation. I was sometimes as guilty of playing the figure-me-out game as Amy was. I've left that bit of information out, too. I'm a big fan of the lie of omission. I pulled up in front of my dad's house just after 10 p.m. It was a tidy little place, a good starter home, or ender home. Two bedrooms, two baths, dining room, dated but decent kitchen, a for sale sign rusted in the front yard. 1 year and not a bite. I entered the stuffy house, the heat rolling over me. The budget alarm system we installed after the third break-in began beeping like a bomb countdown. I input the code, the one that drove Amy insane because it went against every rule about codes. It was my birthday, 8/15/77. Code rejected. I tried again. Code rejected. A bead of sweat rolled down my back. Amy had always threatened to change the code. She said it was pointless to have one that was so guessable, but I knew the real reason. She resented that it was my birthday and not our anniversary. Once again, I'd chosen me over us. My semi-sweet nostalgia for Amy disappeared. I stabbed my finger at the numbers again, growing more panicked as the alarm beeped and beeped and beeped its countdown until it went into full intruder blare. Woonk! 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 My cell phone was supposed to ring so I could give the all clear. Just me, the idiot. But it didn't. I waited a full minute, the alarm reminding me of a torpedoed submarine movie. The canned heat of a closed house in July shimmered over me. My shirt back was already soaked. God damn it, Amy! I scanned the alarm for the company's number and found nothing. I pulled over a chair and began yanking at the alarm. I had it off the wall, hanging by the cords, when my phone finally rang. A bitchy voice on the other end demanded Amy's first pet's name. Woonk! 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 It was exactly the wrong tone. Smug, petulant, utterly unconcerned, and exactly the wrong question, because I didn't know the answer, which infuriated me. No matter how many clues I solved, I'd be faced with some Amy trivia to unman me. Look, this is Nick Dunn. This is my dad's house. This account was set up by me, I snapped. So it doesn't really fucking matter what my wife's first pet's name was. Woonk, woonk, woonk. Please don't take that tone with me, sir. Look, I just came in to grab one thing from my dad's house, and now I'm leaving, okay? I have to notify the police immediately. Can you just turn off the goddamn alarm so I can think? Woonk, woonk, woonk. The alarm's off. The alarm is not off. Sir, I warned you once. Do not take that tone with me. You fucking bitch. You know what? Fuck it. Fuck it. Fuck it. I hung up just as I remembered Amy's cat's name, the very first one, Stuart. I called back, got a different operator, a reasonable operator, who turned off the alarm and, God bless her,
called off the police. I really wasn't in the mood to explain myself. I sat on the thin, cheap carpet and made myself breathe, my heart clattering. After a minute, after my shoulders untensed and my jaw unclenched and my hands unfisted and my heart returned to normal, I stood up and momentarily debated just leaving, as if that would teach Amy a lesson. But as I stood up, I saw a blue envelope left on the kitchen counter, like a Dear John note. I took a deep breath, blew it out, new attitude, and opened the envelope, pulled out the letter marked with a heart. "Hi, darling. So we both have things we want to work on. For me, it'd be my perfectionism, my occasional wishful thinking, self-righteousness. For you, I know you worry that you're sometimes too distant, too removed, unable to be tender or nurturing. Well, I want to tell you, here in your father's house, that isn't true. You are not your father. You need to know that you are a good man. You are a sweet man. You are kind. I've punished you for not being able to read my mind sometimes, for not being able to act in exactly the way I wanted you to act right at exactly that moment. I punished you for being a real, breathing man. I ordered you around instead of trusting you to find your way. I didn't give you the benefit of the doubt that no matter how much you and I blunder, you always love me and want me to be happy. And that should be enough for any girl, right? I worry I've said things about you that aren't actually true, and that you've come to believe them. So I am here to say now, you are warm. You are my son." If Amy were with me, as she'd planned on being, she would have nuzzled into me the way she used to do, her face in the crook of my neck, and she would have kissed me and smiled and said, "You are, you know, my son." My throat tight, I took a final look around my father's house and left, closing the door on the heat. In my car, I fumbled open the envelope marked "Fourth Clue." We had to be near the end. "Picture me. I'm a girl who is very bad. I need to be punished, and by punished, I mean had. It's where you store goodies for anniversary 5. Pardon me if this is getting contrived. A good time was had here right at sunny midday. Then out for a cocktail, all so terribly gay. So run there right now, full of sweet sighs, and open the door for your big surprise." My stomach seized. I didn't know what this one meant. I reread it. I couldn't even guess. Amy had stopped taking it easy on me. I wasn't going to finish the treasure hunt after all. I felt a surge of angst. What a fucking day. Boney was out to get me. Noelle was insane. Shauna was pissed. Hillary was resentful. The woman at the security company was a bitch. And my wife had stumped me finally. It was time to end this goddamn day. There was only one woman I could stand to be around right now. Go took one look at me, rattled, tight-lipped, and heat-exhausted from my dad's, and parked me on the couch, announced she'd make some late dinner. 5 minutes later, she was stepping carefully toward me, balancing my meal on an ancient TV tray. An old dun standby. Grilled cheese and barbecue chips. A plastic cup of... "It's not Kool-Aid," Go said. "It's beer." Kool-Aid seemed a little too regressive. "This is very nurturing and strange of you, Go." "You're cooking tomorrow," Hope you like canned soup. She sat down on the couch next to me, stole a chip from my plate, and asked, too casually, any thoughts on why the cops would ask me if Amy was still a size 2? Jesus, they won't fucking let that go, I said. Doesn't it freak you out? Like they found her clothes or something? They'd have asked me to identify them, right? She thought about that a second, her face pinched. That makes sense, she said. Her face remained pinched until she caught me looking. Then she smiled. I taped the ball game. Wanna watch? You okay? I'm okay. I felt awful, my stomach greasy, my psyche crackling. Maybe it was the clue I couldn't figure out, but I suddenly felt like I'd overlooked something. I'd made some huge mistake, and my error would be disastrous. Maybe it was my conscience, scratching back to the surface from its secret oubliette. Go pulled up the game and, for the next 10 minutes, remarked on the game only, and only between sips of her beer. Go didn't like grilled cheese. She was scooping peanut butter out of the jar onto saltines. When a commercial break came on, she paused and said, if I had a dick, I would fuck this peanut butter, deliberately spraying cracker bits toward me. I think if you had a dick, all sorts of bad things would happen. She fast-forwarded through a nothing inning, cards trailing by 5. When it was time for the next commercial break, Go paused, said, so I called to change my cell phone plan today, and the hold song was Lionel Richie. Do you ever listen to Lionel Richie? I like Penny Lover, but the song wasn't Penny Lover. But anyway, then a woman came on the line, and she said the customer service reps are all based in Baton Rouge, which was strange because she didn't have an accent, but she said she grew up in New Orleans, and it's a little-known fact that, what do you call someone from New Orleans? A New Orleansian? Anyway, that they don't have much of an accent. So she said for my package, Package A. Go and I had a game inspired by our mom, who had a habit of telling such outrageously mundane, endless stories that Go was positive she had to be secretly fucking with us. For about 10 years now, whenever Go and I hit a conversation lull, one of us would break in with a story about appliance repair or coupon fulfillment. Go had more stamina than I did, though. Her stories could drone on, seamlessly, forever. They went on so long that they became genuinely annoying and then swung back around to hilarious. Go was moving on to a story about her refrigerator light and showed no signs of faltering. Filled with a sudden, heavy gratefulness, I leaned across the couch and kissed her on the cheek. What's that for? Just thanks. I felt my eyes get full with tears. I looked away for a second to blink them off, and Go said, so I needed a AAA battery, which, as it turns out, is different from a transistor battery, so I had to find the receipt to return the transistor battery. We finished watching the game. Cards lost. When it was over, Go switched the TV to mute. You want to talk, or do you want more distraction? Whatever you need. You go on to bed, Go. I'm just going to flip around. Probably sleep. I need to sleep. You want an Ambien? My twin was a staunch believer in the easiest way. No relaxation tapes or whale noises for her. Pop a pill? Get unconscious. Nah. They're in the medicine cabinet if you change your mind. If there was ever a time for assisted sleep. She hovered over me for just a few seconds,
then, go-like, trotted down the hall, clearly not sleepy, and closed her door, knowing the kindest thing was to leave me alone. A lot of people lacked that gift, knowing when to fuck off. People love talking, and I have never been a huge talker. I carry on an inner monologue, but the words often don't reach my lips. She looks nice today, I'd think, but somehow it wouldn't occur to me to say it out loud. My mom talked, my sister talked. I'd been raised to listen. So, sitting on the couch by myself, not talking, felt decadent. I leafed through one of Go's magazines, flipped through TV channels, finally alighting on an old black-and-white show, men in fedoras scribbling notes while the pretty housewife explained that her husband was away in Fresno, which made the two cops look at each other significantly and nod. I thought of Gilpin and Boney, and my stomach lurched. In my pocket, my disposable cell phone made a mini jackpot sound that meant I had a text. I'm outside. Open the door.
Amy Elliott Dunn, April 28th, 2011. Diary entry. Just got to keep on keeping on. That's what Mama Mo says, and when she says it, her sureness, each word emphasized as if it really were a viable life strategy, the cliché stops being a set of words and turns into something real, valuable. Keep on keeping on exactly, I think. I do love that about the Midwest. People don't make a big deal about everything, not even death. Mama Mo will just keep on keeping on until the cancer shuts her down, and then she will die. So I'm keeping my head down and making the best of a bad situation. And I mean that in the deep, literal Mama Mo usage. I keep my head down and do my work. I drive Mo to doctor's appointments and chemo appointments. I change the sickly water in the flower vase in Nick's father's room, and I drop off cookies for the staff so they take good care of him. I'm making the best of a really bad situation, and the situation is mostly bad because my husband, who brought me here, who uprooted me to be closer to his ailing parents, seems to have lost all interest in both me and said ailing parents. Nick has written off his father entirely. He won't even say the man's name. I know every time we get a phone call from Comfort Hill, Nick is hoping it's the announcement that his dad is dead. As for Mo, Nick sat with his mom during a single chemo session and pronounced it unbearable. He said he hated hospitals, he hated sick people, he hated the slowly ticking time, the IV bag dripping molasses slow. He just couldn't do it. And when I tried to talk him back into it, when I tried to stiffen his spine with some, gotta do what you gotta do, he told me to do it. So I did. I have. Mama Mo, of course, takes on the burden of his blame. We sat one day, partly watching a romantic comedy on my computer, but mostly chatting while the IV dripped. So, slowly. And as the spunky heroine tripped over a sofa, Mo turned to me and said, "Don't be too hard on Nick about not wanting to do this kind of thing. I just always doted on him. I babied him. How could you not? That face. And so he has trouble doing hard things. But I truly don't mind, Amy. Truly." "You should mind," I said. "Nick doesn't have to prove his love for me," she said, patting my hand. "I know he loves me." I admire Mo's unconditional love. I do. so I don't tell her what I have found on Nick's computer, the book proposal for a memoir about a Manhattan magazine writer who returns to his Missouri roots to care for both his ailing parents. Nick has all sorts of bizarre things on his computer, and sometimes I can't resist a little light snooping. It gives me a clue as to what my husband is thinking. His search history gave me the latest. Noir films and the website of his old magazine and a study on the Mississippi River, whether it's possible to free-float from here to the Gulf. I know what he pictures, floating down the Mississippi like Huck Finn and writing an article about it. Nick is always looking for angles. I was nosing through all this when I found the book proposal. Double Lives, A Memoir of Ends and Beginnings, will especially resonate with Gen X males, the original man boys, who are just beginning to experience the stress and pressures involved with caring for aging parents. In Double Lives, I will detail my growing understanding of a troubled, once-distant father, my painful, forced transformation from a carefree young man into the head of a family as I deal with the imminent death of a much-loved mother, the resentment my Manhattanite wife feels at this detour in her previously charmed life. My wife, it should be mentioned, is Amy Elliott Dunn, the inspiration for the best-selling Amazing Amy series. The proposal was never completed, I assume because Nick realized he wasn't going to ever understand his once-distant father, and because Nick was shirking all head-of-the-family duties, and because I wasn't expressing any anger about my new life. A little frustration, yes, but no book-worthy rage. For so many years, my husband has lauded the emotional solidity of Midwesterners, stoic, humble, without affectation. But these aren't the kinds of people who provide good memoir material. Imagine the jacket copy. People behaved mostly well, and then they died. Still, it stings a bit, the resentment my Manhattanite wife feels. Maybe I do feel stubborn. I think of how consistently lovely Maureen is, and I worry that Nick and I were not meant to be matched, that he would be happier with a woman who thrills at husband care and homemaking. And I'm not disparaging these skills. I wish I had them. I wish I cared more that Nick always has his favorite toothpaste, that I know his collar size off the top of my head, that I am an unconditionally loving woman whose greatest happiness is making my man happy. I was that way for a while with Nick, but it was unsustainable. I'm not selfless enough. Only child, as Nick points out regularly. But I try. I keep on keeping on, and Nick runs around town like a kid again. He's happy to be back in his rightful prom king place. He dropped about 10 pounds. He got a new haircut. He bought new jeans. He looks frickin' great. But I only know that from the glimpses of him coming home or going back out, always in a pretend hurry. You wouldn't like it, his standard response any time I ask to come with him, wherever it is he goes. Just like he jettisoned his parents when they were of no use to him, he's dropping me because I don't fit in his new life. He'd have to work to make me comfortable here, and he doesn't want to do that. He wants to enjoy himself. Stop it. Stop it. I must look on the bright side. Literally. I must take my husband out of my dark, shadowy thoughts and shine some cheerful, golden light on him. I must do better at adoring him like I used to. Nick responds to adoration. I just wish it felt more equal. My brain is so busy with Nick thoughts. It's a swarm inside my head. Nick, 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 Nick. And when I picture his mind, I hear my name as a shy crystal ping that occurs once, maybe twice a day, and quickly subsides. I just wish he thought about me as much as I do him. Is that wrong? I don't even know anymore.
Nick Dunn. 4 days gone. She was standing there in the orange glow of the streetlight, in a flimsy sundress, her hair wavy from the humidity. Andy. She rushed through the doorway, her arms splayed to hug me, and I hissed, "Wait, wait!" and shut the door just before she wrapped herself around me. She pressed her cheek against my chest, and I put my hand on her bare back and closed my eyes. I felt a queasy mixture of relief and horror. When you finally stop an itch and realize it's because you've ripped a hole in your skin. I have a mistress. Now is the part where I have to tell you I have a mistress and you stop liking me. If you liked me to begin with. I have a pretty, young, very young mistress. And her name is Andy. I know. It's bad.
"Baby, why the fuck haven't you called me?"
she said, her face still pressed against me. "I know, sweetheart, I know. You just can't imagine. It's been a nightmare. How did you find me?" She held on to me.
"Your house was dark, so I figured try goes."
Andy knew my habits, knew my habitats. We've been together a while. I have a pretty, very young mistress, and we've been together a while.
"I was worried about you, Nick. Frantic. I'm sitting at Maddie's house, and the TV is, like, just on, and all of a sudden, on the TV, I see this, like, guy who looks like you talking about his missing wife. And then I realize it is you. Can you imagine how freaked out I was? And you didn't even try to reach me?"
"I called you."
"Don't say anything. Sit tight. Don't say anything till we talk. That's an order. That's not you trying to reach me."
"I haven't been alone much. People have been around me all the time. Amy's parents, Go, the police." I breathed into her hair.
"Amy's just gone?"
she asked. "She's just gone." I pulled myself from her and sat down on the couch, and she sat beside me, her leg pressed against mine, her arm brushing against mine. Someone took her.
"Nick, are you okay?"
Her chocolatey hair fell in waves over her chin, collarbone, breasts, and I watched one single strand shake in the stream of her breathing. "No, not really." I gave her the shh sign and pointed toward the hallway. "My sister." We sat side by side, silent, the TV flickering the old cop show, the men in fedoras making an arrest. I felt her hand wriggle into mine. She leaned into me as if we were settling in for a movie night, some lazy, carefree couple, and then she pulled my face toward her and kissed me. "Andy, no," I whispered.
"Yes, I need you."
She kissed me again and climbed onto my lap, where she straddled me, her cotton dress slipping up around her knees, one of her flip-flops falling to the floor.
"Nick, I've been so worried about you. I need to feel your hands on me. That's all I've been thinking about. I'm scared."
Andy was a physical girl, and that's not code for "it's all about the sex."
She was a hugger, a toucher. She was prone to running her fingers through my hair or down my back in a friendly scratch. She got reassurance and comfort from touching. And yes, fine, she also liked sex. With one quick tug, she yanked down the top of her sundress and moved my hands onto her breasts. My canine loyal lust surfaced. "I want to fuck you," I almost said aloud. "You are warm," my wife said in my ear. I lurched away. I was so tired. The room was swimming.
"Nick?"
Her bottom lip was wet with my spit.
"What? Are we not okay? Is it because of Amy?"
Andy had always felt young. She was 23. Of course she felt young. But right then I realized how grotesquely young she was. How irresponsibly, disastrously young she was. Ruinously young. Hearing my wife's name on her lips always jarred me. She said it a lot. She liked to discuss Amy, as if Amy were the heroine on a nighttime soap opera. Andy never made Amy the enemy. She made her a character. She asked questions all the time, about our life together, about Amy.
"What did you guys do together in New York? Like, what did you do on the weekends?"
Andy's mouth went, "Oh," once when I told her about going to the opera.
"You went to the opera? What did she wear? Full length? And a wrap or a fur? And her jewelry and her hair?"
Also, what were Amy's friends like? What did we talk about? What was Amy like really like? Was she like the girl in the books, perfect? It was Andy's favorite bedtime story, Amy. "My sister is in the other room, sweetheart. You shouldn't even be here. God, I want you here, but you really shouldn't have come, babe. Until we know what we're dealing with."
"You are brilliant. You are witty. You are warm. Now kiss me."
Andy remained atop me, her breasts out, nipples going hard from the air conditioning.
"Baby, what we're dealing with right now is I need to make sure we're okay. That's all I need."
She pressed against me, warm and lush.
"That's all I need. Please, Nick. I'm freaked out. I know you. I know you don't want to talk right now, and that's fine. But I need you to be with me."
And I wanted to kiss her then, the way I had that very first time. Our teeth bumping, her face tilted to mine, her hair tickling my arms, a wet and tonguey kiss. Me thinking of nothing but the kiss, because it would be dangerous to think of anything but how good it felt. The only thing that kept me from dragging her into the bedroom now was not how wrong it was. It had been many shades of wrong all along, but that now it was actually dangerous. And because there was Amy. Finally, there was Amy. That voice that had made its home in my ear for half a decade. My wife's voice. But now it wasn't chiding. It was sweet again. I hated that three little notes from my wife could make me feel this way, soggy and sentimental. I had absolutely no right to be sentimental. Andy was burrowing into me, and I was wondering if the police had Go's house under surveillance, if I should be listening for a knock at the door. I have a very young, very pretty mistress. My mother had always told her kids, if you're about to do something and you want to know if it's a bad idea, imagine seeing it printed in the paper for all the world to see. Nick Dunn,
a one-time magazine writer, still pride-wounded from a 2010 layoff, agreed to teach a journalism class for North Carthage Junior College. The older married man promptly exploited his position by launching a torrid fuckfest of an affair with one of his impressionable young students. I was the embodiment of every writer's worst fear, a cliché. Now let me string still more clichés together for your amusement. It happened gradually. I never meant to hurt anyone. I got in deeper than I thought I would. But it was more than a fling. It was more than an ego boost. I really love Andy. I do. The class I was teaching, How to Launch a Magazine Career, contained 14 students of varying degrees of skill. All girls. I'd say women, but I think girls is factually correct. They all wanted to work in magazines. They weren't smudgy newsprint girls. They were glossies. They'd seen the movie. They pictured themselves dashing around Manhattan, latte in one hand, cell phone in the other, adorably breaking a designer heel while hailing a cab, and falling into the arms of a charming, disarming soulmate with winningly floppy hair. They had no clue about how foolish, how ignorant, their choice of a major was. I'd been planning on telling them as much, using my layoff as a cautionary tale, although I had no interest in being the tragic figure. I pictured delivering the story nonchalantly, jokingly. No big deal. More time to work on my novel. Then I spent the first class answering so many awestruck questions, and I turned into such a preening gas bag, such a needy fuck, that I couldn't bear to tell the real story. The call into the managing editor's office on the second round of layoffs, the hiking of that doomed path down the long rows of cubicles, all eyes shifting toward me, dead man walking, me still hoping I was going to be told something different, that the magazine needed me now more than ever. Yes! It would be a buck-up speech, an all-hands-on-deck speech. But no. My boss just said, I guess you know, unfortunately, why I called you in here, rubbing his eyes under his glasses to show how weary and dejected he was. I wanted to feel like a shiny, cool winner, so I didn't tell my students about my demise. I told them we had a family illness that required my attention here, which was true, yes, I told myself, entirely true, and very heroic. And pretty, freckled Andy sat a few feet in front of me, wide-set blue eyes under chocolatey waves of hair, cushiony lips parted just a bit, ridiculously large, real breasts, and long, thin legs and arms. An alien fuck doll of a girl, it must be said, as different from my elegant patrician wife as could be. And Andy was radiating body heat and lavender, clicking notes on her laptop, asking questions in a husky voice like, how do you get a source to trust you, to open up to you? And I thought to myself right then, where the fuck did this girl come from? Is this a joke? You ask yourself, why? I'd been faithful to Amy always. I was the guy who left the bar early if a woman was getting too flirty, if her touch was feeling too nice. I was not a cheater. I didn't like cheaters. Dishonest, disrespectful, petty, spoiled. I had never succumbed. But that was back when I was happy. I hate to think the answer is that easy, but I had been happy all my life. And now, I was not. And Andy was there, lingering after class, asking me questions about myself that Amy never had, not lately, making me feel like a worthwhile man, not the idiot who lost his job,
the dope who forgot to put the toilet seat down, the blunderer who just could never quite get it right, whatever it was. Andy brought me an apple one day. A Red Delicious, title of the memoir of our affair, if I were to write one. She asked me to give her story an early look. It was a profile of a stripper at a St. Louis club, and it read like a penthouse forum piece, and Andy began eating my apple while I read it, leaning over my shoulder, the juice sitting ludicrously on her lip. And then I thought, holy shit, this girl is trying to seduce me. Foolishly shocked, an aging Benjamin Braddock. It worked. I began thinking of Andy as an escape, an opportunity, an option. I'd come home to find Amy in a tight ball on the sofa, Amy staring at the wall, silent, never saying the first word to me, always waiting, a perpetual game of ice-breaking, a constant mental challenge. What will make Amy happy today? I would think, Andy wouldn't do that. As if I knew Andy. Andy would laugh at that joke. Andy would like that story. Andy was a nice, pretty, bosomy Irish girl from my hometown, unassuming and jolly. Andy sat in the front row of my class, and she looked soft, and she looked interested. When I thought about Andy, my stomach didn't hurt the way it did with my wife, the constant dread of returning to my own home, where I wasn't welcome. I began imagining how it might happen. I began craving her touch. Yes, it was like that, just like a lyric from a bad 80s single. I craved her touch. I craved touch in general, because my wife avoided mine. At home, she slipped past me like a fish, sliding just out of grazing distance in the kitchen or the stairwell. We watched TV silently on our two sofa cushions, as separate as if they were life rafts. In bed, she turned away from me, pushed blankets and sheets between us. I once woke up in the night and, knowing she was asleep, pulled aside her halter strap a bit, and pressed my cheek and palm against her bare shoulder. I couldn't get back to sleep that night. I was so disgusted with myself. I got out of bed and masturbated in the shower, picturing Amy, the lusty way she used to look at me, those heavy-lidded moonrise eyes taking me in, making me feel seen. When I was done, I sat down in the bathtub, and stared at the drain through the spray. My penis lay pathetically along my left thigh, like some small animal washed ashore. I sat at the bottom of the bathtub, humiliated, trying not to cry. So it happened. In a strange, sudden snowstorm in early April, not April of this year, April of last year. I was working the bar alone because Go was having a mom night. We took turns not working, staying home with our mother and watching bad TV. Our mom was going fast. She wouldn't last the year, not even close. I was actually feeling okay right at that moment. My mom and Go were snuggled up at home watching an Annette Funicello beach movie, and the bar had had a busy, lively night, one of those nights where everyone seemed to have come off a good day. Pretty girls were nice to homely guys. People were buying rounds for strangers just because. It was festive. And then it was the end of the night. Time to close, everybody out. I was about to lock the door when Andy flung it wide and stepped in, almost on top of me, and I could smell the light beer sweetness on her breath, the scent of wood smoke in her hair. I paused for that jarring moment when you try to process someone you've seen in only one setting, put them in a new context. Andy in the bar. Okay.
She laughed a pirate wench laugh and pushed me back inside.